Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. The president of the International Catholic Migration Commission explains the history, the work, and the goal of the organization. Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright reflects on the Feast of the Epiphany and on the fact that it is the moment that binds the whole human race together in this event. People move for lots of reasons. ICMC moves with them. That's the logo of the International Catholic Migration Commission, and it leaps to your eyes as soon as you open its website. Further on, the homepage explains that the ICMC serves and protects the needs of uprooted people, refugees, internally displaced persons and migrants, with operations in 30 countries of the world. It advocates for durable solutions and rights-based policies directly and through a worldwide network of member organisations. ICMC's president, John Klink, was just recently in Rome for a meeting. He took time to come into Vatican Radio for a chat with my colleague Irene Lagan. He told her that the organisation goes back quite a few years. In fact, it was founded in 1951 by Pope Pius XII.
You can actually read about our founding in an apostolic constitution, which is the highest form of papal document, called Exul Familia Nazaritana, which is called the Exiled Family of Nazareth. And in it, the Holy Father describes the reasons why ICMC was founded, which is to deal with the refugees. And at that point, it was the onslaught of refugees throughout Europe, from Europe. So it was an inter-Europe question. And the Apostolic Constitution describes how the Holy Father gave instructions, for instance, for the Church to open the doors of all of the convents, all of the monasteries, even the Vatican and Castel Sant'Angelo, to take in refugee families. So I think that's very indicative of the concern and openness of the Church for the issue of migration.
And John points out it also has a very theological focus.
When you consider that the exiled family of Nazareth, that is the Holy Family, and not only was Christ made man, but immediately upon being made man, he was made into a refugee within the first, presumably the first days or weeks of his birth. And St. Joseph, therefore, took on the mantle of the archetype of all refugee families, because as the story is clearly recounted in the Bible, he was woken up in the middle of the night by the angel and told to get up and grab his family and leave in the middle of the night immediately. And he did. And he did not wait until daybreak, and he just grabbed them and left because they were in danger. And I think that's very clearly the issue of so many and the plight of so many refugees that suddenly find their life turned upside down.
So taking it from there, Pope Pius XII, at the behest of his pro-secretary of state at the time, Cardinal Montini, the man who was later to become Pope Paul VI, and of Cardinal Frings of Cologne, co-founded ICMC. They wanted it to be located in Geneva, so it would be able to give a Catholic and Christian perspective at the Table of Nations when they were discussing the needs of refugees and migrants, because, of course, Geneva is where a lot of United Nations activities take place.
In the early days, the work consisted primarily of giving loans to refugee families in order to either go to another country or to come back home if that was a possibility for them. And then subsequently, with major developments such as the war in Vietnam, the major focus became resettling refugees during the war and after the war. And so ICMC has resettled over 1 million refugees in the United States alone.
So from about 1952 to the present day, he pointed out, it has taken care of over 1 million refugees. And today there is much to be done.
If you look at the overall figures, there's 200 million migrants. There's about 14 million refugees and 27 million trafficked peoples as an estimate. So it's not that we're wondering what to do every day.
Now, you mentioned this issue of refugees. So this problem really has increased over the years, obviously. And is this a renewed emphasis that the Holy See is placing on the work of the Commission?
It is. Because of this increase, and because of we're in a globalized world, and it is the Church's teaching that people should be allowed to find a better life, but also it's the teaching that the best thing of all is for people to have the right to remain where they are and not have to leave. And so that brings in the whole issue of development and overall justice issues. And so, however, bearing in mind that that's the best, one has to deal with the realities that one is dealt. And so the realities are that there are still extraordinary large numbers of refugees. And one of the major problems is, in terms of migrants, first of all, the best thing is to have them protected at home. But if they are overseas, then to make sure that somehow they are taken care of and that they have a real chance of inculcating themselves into society, inserting themselves into society in a very profitable and mutually satisfactory way. Because it's very clear that Western societies in the United States, which has an extraordinary history of migration, and now in Europe also, that Europeans need many of these people to help them in their economies. And the major focus that ICMC wants to be sure of is that people are not used simply as tools, but that they are treated with complete respect, as is due them, as part of Catholic social teaching, that the most important thing is the human dignity of the person. And as a result of that, that also applies to them being able to have their families and not be separated from their families for extended periods of time.
Do you have any particular areas of concern or main focus now?
I just returned with my Secretary General from a visit to Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. And that was a visit to see what our programs were doing and what gaps there still are in terms of the migration situation. And the most alarming part of the aftermath of the Iraqi war is the issue of the minorities that have been forced to flee. And it's not only Christians, but it is all sorts of other sects and people who are not Christian. But the plight of Christians is particularly imperative to be looked at and dealt with, because the Holy Father, as the war was about to happen, John Paul II, was very clear that he was worried about the complete downfall of Christianity and the extinction of Christianity in the Middle East, and in particular in Iraq. And unfortunately, that prophecy seems to be being fulfilled. There was an estimate that there were about 1,200,000 Christians in Iraq before the war, and now the estimate is 400,000. So a full three-quarters of the people have fled. And the most recent, very troubling development within the last couple of months was that there was a change in the Iraqi constitution, and for reasons which are not exactly clear, they removed the protection of minorities. There was an Article 50 in the Constitution, and they removed that article, and that seemed to be used as a license by extremists in Iraq to seek out Christians.
One of the most moving stories, John said, was told to him by a mother and her daughter.
The daughter was actually working in a Iraqi ministry around Mosul, and she received a phone call on her cell phone. It was an anonymous caller saying, "We know that you're a Christian, and if you do not leave within the hour, you will be murdered." So she immediately left, said goodbye to her fellow workers who were Muslims. And I said, "By the way, how did they react?" And she said, "We were all crying." And I went to my house and threw some things in my suitcase. And we were fortunate because we had visas and we were able to leave. But many of my friends, she said, were unable to leave. And so many of them are living in multiple families in one house, in order that when a person has to go out to get food, it's only one person for several families, because that person might not come back.
Apart from that situation in the Middle East, what are some other areas? I mean, there's so many, the DRC, even Myanmar, places like that. What are some other areas of significant concern at this point in time for ICMC?
One of the other issues that we are very, very focused on is that of human trafficking. One thinks that after the Civil War in the United States and after the 1850s in Great Britain, that slavery is finished and gone. But unfortunately, slavery is alive, and I don't know if you can call it well, but it's certainly alive. And it's demonstrated in the fact that there are 27 estimated million people and a large, large, large number of women and children who are the victims of trafficking. And that can be all the way from made into sexual slaves, made into prostitutes, or even simply being used and abused.
For instance, John said he was interviewing women in Hong Kong recently, and the women spoke of the fact that in order to get a job overseas, they are requested to pay in advance one-third of their two-year salary, which inevitably leads them to borrow sums of money that plunge them into debt from the very beginning.
And so these poor women are leaving home, going overseas, and all automatically they are in debt. And then many of them face an issue when they get to their job that their passport is taken away by their employer. They're often beaten. They are often, very often, raped. They are not given their salaries. When I was in Lebanon a couple weeks ago, we sat and listened to the plight of this one girl who had just come in. I mean, a girl, she was, I guess, in her 30s, and she looked like she was probably 50, because she said every week my employers would beat me three or four times a week. It was both the woman and the man that would beat her. And she said, and I don't know why they would beat me, because I tried to do everything right. And she said, and I didn't realize that the person that worked there before me had actually jumped out of the window and committed suicide.
That's really tragic. How does the church work in to counter this problem, or how do you counter this issue?
For instance, in Lebanon, we have a safe house, and that is an extraordinary refuge for these women. And this woman, it's the first time she has been safe in 4 years. I mean, there's stories of being electrocuted, being burned by irons, being it's just abominable. And so the several ways that it is imperative, in my view, to counter not only the actual, to try to bring these women into a refuge, but to stop the predators from getting at them. So one of the things that we are developing is some system whereby we can try to identify brokers who are reputable, and perhaps it might even be church agencies in some cases, where they would be able to identify potential jobs for women overseas wherein they will not have to face that. And also to develop systems whereby they will have a pension, that they will have some medical health care program, and that they will have some way of savings.
A very interesting program, John said, is conducted by the Good Shepherd Sisters in the Philippines, wherein they do a pastoral with the families of the women who are going over.
To teach them what the dangers are, and to make sure that they realize and recognize the dangers and to be alert for them, but also that they do not become too materialistic themselves, that is the families. Because you can imagine the poor woman, if she's working overseas and her family is saying, well, gee, you know, that television we bought is nice, but really the people next door have a bigger one. And couldn't you send more money? And, you know, she's alone, she's without her family, and she's working as much as she possibly can, saving as much as she possibly can, but yet to have that extra pressure would just be devastating.
Ideally, he says, it would be important to have educational programs also for the employer families.
To try to sensitize them to the issues. Mind you, some of the people are simply evil. I mean, anybody who burns or tries to electrocute a woman should be locked in jail and the key thrown away. But it's an issue that so many people are unaware of. And I was recently at a conference, and this professor was talking about the fact that he is an expert on human trafficking. And yet he was bowled over when he read in the Chronicle, he lives in San Francisco, that the restaurant where he eats at least once a week, all of the women who waited on him were actually trafficked women. And he didn't pick up on it. So people you see every day might be in total jeopardy and danger and afraid to talk to anyone.
John says the ICMC is also involved in setting up projects for police and military personnel to train them to look for the telltale signs of women or anyone being trafficked.
What is your goal for 2009, for the year ahead?
We have just had a reconstituted board, and the reason I'm in Rome is because we had our governing committee, and we were lucky enough to have elections of some extraordinary and eminent people. And there's now four cardinals and a patriarch who are members of our board, Cardinal Schoenborn, the Archbishop of Vienna, Cardinal Pell, the Archbishop of Sydney, Cardinal Oscar Andres Rodriguez Maradiaga, the Archbishop of Tegucigalpa in Honduras, who's also the president of Caritas Internationalis, and Cardinal Njue of the Archbishop of Nairobi, as well as the Greek Melkite Patriarch Gregorius III of Damascus. And so with that sort of expression of concern on the part of the Church, being particularly focused on this in all regions of the world, our goal is to really spread the message amongst all of the Church to ensure that all bishops' conferences are made aware of this, of the various needs for migration concern. And our members are all of the bishops' conferences of the world. And that is an extraordinary network. And it spreads to every part of the globe and is a testament to Christ's concern for the poor.
You've been listening to John Klink, President of the International Catholic Migration Commission, speaking to Irene Lagan. On January the 6th, we celebrate the Epiphany. It's the feast commemorating Christ's manifestation to the Gentiles in the person of the Magi, and according to the Catholic Dictionary, it began in the East in the 3rd century and soon spread to the West, where it is identified with the visit of the three kings. In some countries, it's known as Twelfth Night, and it is the occasion for special celebrations. But that's rather dry, isn't it? I asked Benedictine abbot, Timothy Wright, for his reflections as we think back to that momentous moment in history when three wise men travelled afar to pay tribute to the baby Jesus.
On the 6th of January, in the Western Church, we keep the feast of the Epiphany, which is the moment when the three wise men, sometimes called the three kings, visit Jesus, the newly born Jesus, in Bethlehem. Its importance lies in the fact that it is the moment when the world beyond the chosen people, beyond the Jewish people, came to acknowledge the importance and uniqueness of this baby Jesus, bringing gifts from the East. It's a wonderful moment because it's the moment that binds the whole human race together in this event, because those three wise men represent all the rest of us who are not Jewish people. And that is a very powerful thought, particularly in a world of 6 billion people of many different languages, living in vastly different climates and different social and economic conditions. It's a moment when dialogue, when recognition, when mutual respect are virtues which are exemplified in the way that the Holy Family received these guests and accepted their offerings. And these three guests recognized the significance of this baby in the honor they paid, in the gestures they used. One of the ways over this Christmas period where we can ponder the Christian message is by looking at the many works of art that are portrayed in Christmas cards and other pictures. And I have collected over the years a few of these cards and would like to share one or two of them with you, simply as a way of illustrating this unique and important feast. There is a mosaic, the Adoration of the Magi, in the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore, which represents Mary holding Jesus in a sort of rather more stable building than you would find as a cave. But the kings advance one behind the other, bearing their gifts, and the first, in paying homage to Jesus, has removed his crown, and the others are following up behind. A recognition in art that this is something special. And the Jesus, the baby Jesus, is shown in the mosaic to be rather older than a few days from his birth. When we get a little further down the line in the works of Giotto, we have another style. We have the baby smaller this time, but the first king is on his knees kissing the feet of the baby Jesus. But the baby Jesus is not only with his mother and father, but also with angels. This is a moment when the world outside is coming to recognize what God has done. If we advance again, we find in the 15th century, the works of Fra Angelico in Florence, we have again a different sort of picture. This time a picture of a house with the kings assembled alongside, but the same gesture. The kings kissing the feet of the baby Jesus, paying homage. And we look again in the works of Georges de Latour, a much simpler representation. This time the gifts coming from people from behind, pictured coming from behind, looking outwards with the baby Jesus asleep. Serenely, no touching, no adoration. Advancing down the centuries, they find in the Franz von Roden of the 19th century's nativity scene, much more elaborate, more people around, the kings again obeying before Jesus. This time, Jesus showing some recognition, not kissing at the feet, but eye contact to eye contact. Mary quietly holding Jesus, watching, and Jesus looking intently into the eyes of the king. And finally, just to show that it's not always obedience and it's not always something mind-expanding, a Christmas card with a different sort of story. Christmas card of a boy, probably done while he was at primary school, with the three kings advancing in rather stiff fashion with their crowns on their heads, to Jesus almost lost in his manger. The poignancy of that card is that that young man was to die in a car accident a few years ago, aged 19. Yes, in birth and in adoration, we look forward to death and resurrection. And as we contemplate this feast, there will be many people who carry within them that sense of sorrow, of separation, which death has brought to them in recent months and years, a death which they perhaps haven't always got over. And there is always a sense that in our community of mankind, we bring death to each other by our rivalry, our competitiveness, by our intolerance, our inability to forgive, for all sorts of reasons. And yet, in this one feast, where the three wise men approach the Holy Family, the King of Kings, Jesus, Son of God, as baby, we know that the seeds of being one, of being tolerant and forgiving, of being able to live in a world where the space is becoming more limited, where the greed and the competitiveness are becoming more destructive. But we know that the challenge to live for the other has never been greater. And the journey that those three wise men made, the journey across culture, across a desert, across a whole religious world to another, is a journey that each of us is yearning to make. And those of us who are Christians and accepting in this birth, recognizing the significance of this visit, know it's our responsibility to portray it in ways that Jesus would recognize, ways of openness, of affirmation, ways of encouragement, ways of forgiveness, ways of optimism, ways of hope, ways of life without end. And that within that context, our weakness and sin can, if we are prepared to allow it, be forgiven, be accepted. And the pains that we inflict on each other can become reduced as we reflect that behind all pain there is a God who is love, who shared his life with us in a unique way in Jesus Christ, and empowers us now through the Holy Spirit to go on living that life, affirming every man, woman, or child whom we meet as God in front of me. That is the mystery of that visit to Bethlehem by those three wise men. The God in Jesus recognized the creating Father, the God present in those three visitors, and the significance of their visit. That is the example for each of us, whatever corner of this limited world we live and whatever environment we find ourselves in. And it is God with us, deeper than our tragedies and our sufferings and our pain, offering hope. A hope, difficult as it may be, a hope which endures. Amen.
That's all from the English feature program today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.